You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Crackers, napkins, Clorox disinfecting bleach. Check. Now roses, what if they wilt?
Attention shoppers, Clorox disinfecting bleach is a great way to keep flowers fresh for longer. It'll even work for that ink stain on your shirt.
Ah, not again.
Clean anything with the versatile Clorox disinfecting bleach. Discover more hacks at Clorox.com/learn.
Dad Bod, Rap Pod. It's another day. Damone is out sick this week. Our normal host, Damone Carter. I am Nate LeBlanc. I'm our co-host and producer, and I'm here with David Ma, internationally known hip-hop writer, man of mystery, man of history. What's up, dude?
Yo, what's up? Thank you for the introduction, man. That was beyond my means, for sure. I don't know how accurate that is, but it's really good to be here. It's kind of a beautiful day in the Bay Area. So, you know, that's always good to see.
It is. It's a lovely day. It's been a mild summer, like high 80s. The sun is out. We're obviously kind of stuck at home, but trying to, you know, just do what we can to be good citizens, but also kind of have some semblance of a life.
Totally, totally. Nate and I, for listeners out there, rode our bikes around Santa Clara a couple of days ago. It was really nice. Trying to not get ran over by cars on the overpass. But other than that, man, yeah.
Totally. We had a socially distanced hang. Our first one since quarantine started.
Right.
We acted like teenagers. We rode bikes. We went to the liquor store. We bought beers. We hung out in the park. We talked about philosophy and life and how much money our friends make.
Yeah.
So I told you I was going to surprise you with a topic. I just wanted your gut reaction, so I didn't want to prompt you too much. And this is David Ma. How do you feel about the concept of digitally detoxing? Do you ever take time away from your phone, your computer, your laptop, and like not do that?
Yes. I do, but definitely not enough. And I definitely am for digital detoxing. It makes perfect sense. I mean, if you just eat fast food and crap and stuff, your body is going to react to that. I think I've said this on the show before. And if you're just on the internet and you feed yourself bad info, bad everything, it's going to affect your brain, just like food affects your body.
Do you think you can follow the right people and like algorithm your way into a healthy online experience, or is it inherently toxic?
I don't think it's inherently toxic. I think you can definitely sort of craft your own timeline and just be not exposed to anything. I mean, I think the most toxic parts of Twitter and Facebook are like the comment sections. I mean, at this point we know who the bots are. This is obviously a fake account. You know, this person is here to just stir up trouble. But in general, very down for the digital detox. About yourself? You had a lovely day at the beach today, man. That sounds like quite the detox.
And it really put me in that mode of where I was like, I need to do this more and I need mm-hmm. to do it soon. Mm-hmm. And like the thing that really got me thinking was for our anniversary last year, my wife and I got this little cabin in this little town called Jenner. It's like on the Russian River in like Northern California, maybe like 2 hours north of San Francisco. And we didn't know it didn't have internet until we got there. Ooh. So I had like, it's actually funny and this will actually be funny to you and just seem weird to other people who are listening. But like, I was working on a piece that I'm still working on, Eric. And I had, I don't have Microsoft Word on my laptop, but I had brought my laptop and I was like, oh, I'll just work in the Google Doc. Right. And right. At that point, I was like close to finishing up a draft that I thought was going to be something and still tinkering. But anyway, it kind of threw that plan off course. But so I spent, I think, 4 days. Like, I would have to go into town to get signal to send a text. Like, that's how out of the loop we were. Like, I couldn't even do text. So it was a nice, clean, refreshing break. I just focused on like cooking and like mm-hmm. being with Lucia and reading, mm-hmm. just kind of hanging out. And I feel like I have another one of those coming. I kind of tried to do that today, but like I also had to know that Damone got sick and who today's guests were and do a little right. research and all right. that stuff. But while we were out at the beach, which was lovely, and most people had masks on and we stayed away from each other, you know, I tried.
Well, then that leads me to a second question. I mean, what's the longest you've gone without internet, you would say?
I would say like 3 days since. So I was a late adopter to cell phones. Like, I had a BlackBerry when everyone was getting iPhones.
I remember.
Make fun of me. and like, it's weird. I don't have a good plan because I got a plan back then. And I was like, this is for emergencies only. I'll never use a cell phone like a normal thing, and I certainly don't need internet on it, you know what I mean? Right,
totally.
It was like my attitude, which was a terrible attitude, and like just grew less and less true over time. So yeah, I think since I got my first iPhone in like, you know, 2007 or 9 or whenever that was, I think I go on this family camping trip and my service doesn't work up there. So I know for sure I've had a full Friday, full Saturday, maybe part of Sunday.
Nice.
Part of Thursday, like time. What about you?
That's funny. I was just thinking about this the other day. The last time I was without internet, it was for about 2 days. And it wasn't because it wasn't available. It was because we were in Shanghai and Chinese internet is completely filtered. So you literally, you can't get on Google. What do you do? you can get on Yahoo, but it's like this ultra draconian stripped down version where if you type in China thumbs down, it's gonna like go to a black screen.
Wow, ridiculous. That's crazy, dude. So you just kept your phone in your pocket rather than interface with that whole deal.
Totally. I mean, like, all social media apps are blocked and stuff, so you know, occasionally we would use it as a resource, use the internet as a resource, you know, but right. other than that,
like just getting directions and stuff like that.
Right. Totally. Yeah. Directions, the occasional like Yelp review or something. But yeah, that was pretty strange. But you know, it's one of those where it's like, you just exhaled, you know?
Right. Right. So it would be good. Interesting to do. I always associate it with kind of like a pastoralism, like with going out into the woods or to the beach or somewhere right. like beautiful. And totally. So you have other things to occupy your mind. It would be fascinating to be in such a futuristic and yet right. ancient city, and mm-hmm. then also not like there's plenty to look at, look, see, feel, touch, like to do there without mm-hmm. the internet. But it's also like a huge part of modern travel is like summoning cars, finding out where to
totally.
eat, like
totally
what parts of town are the right, like, you know, you guys are not like you guys are more like travelers than tourists, so you don't want to be taken to like Shanghai's Times Square. You want
right,
to like,
right.
go to Shanghai's Brooklyn, you know what I mean? Like,
exactly,
you can't really tell
exactly.
that stuff without the internet, really, unless you have something.
I mean, don't get me wrong. The internet definitely exists there, but it's like this weird stripped down version. that's you're just like, ew, okay, I'm gonna put my phone back in my pocket now. You know
right.
what I mean?
Yeah.
And if you really needed to use it, if you really needed to utilize it for something, then, you know, we pull out our laptops and go to a specific site or something. But yeah, most apps don't work. And like all the ones we're familiar with are just totally weird. And I found myself like reaching for my phone a lot and then being like, what? And then putting it back in, you know?
Totally.
But it was a relief, man. So I am definitely down with the digital detox. I wish I had more, just more will to do it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. It's funny because like I was saying, like I kind of feel like I need to do that coming up soon and try to figure out how to get a couple of days and do it safely, whether at home with like just a total shutdown of like unplugging everything and putting it in the closet, or maybe going to like a cabin kind of situation or out into the woods. But one reason we could never go more than 1 week without the internet is we have a podcast.
I know, totally, totally. Like, and again, it's a resource. I mean, yeah, and we definitely use it as such. And like you were saying earlier, while you're at the beach, it was like, you need the internet to see, to do a little bit of research, to see today's guest, to blah, 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 to X, Y, and Z. And yeah, man, definitely need it. Definitely need it. Especially running a podcast where sometimes, you know, rappers don't get back to you until 30 minutes before. And it's like, hey guys, we're talking to Razzcaz today.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking to, you know, whomever. So that's part of the fun of it too.
Absolutely. It's kind of like with the, you know, more about it than we do right up until you tell us. So it's always just like fascinating to get the, it's like, whoa, cool. All right. Little research coming right up.
Totally.
But the reason I bring it up is we've been talking about banking a few things and like taking a week off maybe, or like it would be like a week off for you guys and like a half week for me, because I'd still post the show and whatnot. But I feel like that's coming more and more closely. And especially with Damone out this week, we're getting kind of a peak of like, I don't think we've hit a wall or anything. We're still really into the show and we love making the show. But like, I feel like we might need a little window.
Oh, for sure. For sure. For sure.
Give our brains a reset. And then I don't know if you feel this way, and I'll kind of segue into music, which is why people tune in. But we had this incredible hot streak where there were so many great records. And then I think in the last week or so, I was kind of like, I don't really want to listen to hip hop right now. Like I'm having a little like, what else is out there? Like I was looking at Spotify history and I was like, okay, it's hip hop adjacent. Let me try that Dinner Party, Terrace Martin album. And like, let me try some indie rock and like, oh, what's going on in jazz? Like, you know, like I just needed to like cleanse the palate a little.
Totally, totally, totally. I mean, that's, you know, we were saying earlier, that's a bit of the detox as well. You know, it's like how many Rock Marcy things can I, you know, dive into? It's like, oh, I'm getting a little tired of it, you know?
Yeah, it just gets, when the tropes don't feel like tropes, they feel like, I don't want to say prisons or something. That's like way too heavy, but like they just
confining.
It feels a little confining. It's like, I need to listen to something outside of this to give me appreciation for when someone is doing a really within genre.
Totally.
Good move. You know what I mean?
Well, speaking of music and speaking of genres and speaking of the internet, unfortunately, we've all learned about Biz Markie and his condition this week. You know, obviously he's a big figure to me as well as you, Nate. I mean, to me, he represents like all that's kind of good about hip hop, you know, all the fun, all the colorfulness, all the almost purity, you know. You know, give people your thoughts about Biz. I mean, shout out to Biz. Obviously, please, please, please get well. 2020 cannot get any more shittier. But Nate, just let people know about Biz Markie and sort of your thoughts on his importance.
Yeah, Biz Markie, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that Biz Markie is one of my favorite artists of all time and someone whose music means a lot to me in my life, and that I've been a consistent fan of since I was a little kid, and like nothing has interrupted. Like he's never really like done me wrong. You know what I mean? It's like,
right.
It's just like Biz Markie is consistent and funny, and he brings like a joie de vivre to the music making process. And he has some, again, like some tropes that he always relies on, like his signature beatboxing moves and his signature rhythms and his signature kind of catchphrases. And more than anything else, Biz Markie is a character, and the character is like this fun loving, like skilled the embodiment of the ethos mm-hmm. of early hip hop.
Totally.
So like is kind of like a sly fox. Like he always gets away with something.
Right. And right.
His music is so fun. And especially the first three or four albums, I just think like that's about as good as like kind of like 80s Marley Marl early chopped sample and
totally.
You know, I don't want to say primitive, but like very but like basic pocket rhyming.
Right.
Right. And I think he's incredibly important in your life too.
Totally. I mean, personality for days. I mean, we're talking about the Biz Markie from like the late 80s, which we like fell in love with. But I mean, even as a social media follow now, you know, he's playing 45s in a onesie. It's amazing. He still retains all that sort of childhood innocence that he projects so well. And he's been doing that for like fucking 30 plus years now. There's not much really more, I mean, to say. I just hope he gets better.
I know. It's like such a bummer to find out that he's not in good health. And diabetes is like such a problem within the culture and within like the kind of like older male demographic of where mm-hmm. a lot of our heroes find themselves. So it's I'm just really hoping that he pulls through. It's
totally.
It's just like hard to think about a world where he doesn't exist and he's
exactly.
not out there. I was just thinking about how he like was so far ahead of so many trends. Like we've been talking a lot about the guy from the Arsonist, I Destroy or Destroy, mm-hmm. I think is
Destroy,
yeah. has the show where everybody shows off all their stuff. Like it's like look at my stuff or something. If it's called something like mm-hmm. And like Biz would be amazing at that. He's got all the like lunch pails and like he's got the 45
totally
size turn like techniques where everyone's totally. Like where did you get that, those are custom, like he totally. Claims to have the Bob James without the bells,
right,
like,
right,
just
right.
Like he's like a legendary collector and he's been collecting for the longest time, and I think when you are kind of a living embodiment of the spirit of the culture like that, people want to give you things mm-hmm. and like give you access, and like he's a legendary record digger, he's a legendary right. performer, he's like he's gone kind of the rapper turned DJ route, and he has mm-hmm. a show on Sirius 43 Rock the Bells LL Cool J's channel, so I think you go straight from Biz's mix show into Roxanne Shanté's talk show.
Oh wow, that's perfect.
Normal day. I know, right? It's like so it's so awesome. We're about to
Marley Marl's in a jet plane picking up and, yeah,
Greg G's dropping science. Big Daddy Kane puts a quarter in yes because you played yourself. Yeah, he's it's just cool to like to see them like surviving and like living into this modern era. So yeah, totally. I just wanted to like chat a little bit about the Biz. It just the news really sucks. I'm like, you never want to see a rapper on TMZ
totally,
for any reason.
Totally.
But when that notification comes through, you're just like, oh my god, this is so
right.
depressing.
Well, I mean, at first you're gonna automatically be like, it was a COVID related, you know. And then yeah. there was a bit of a silence, so that was good to hear that it wasn't. I don't know if necessarily it's better that it's diabetes at this state
right.
of his health, but.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, you know, with Biz being such a comedic value, just so self-deprecating through the years, he's always sort of that bright spot that you look back to, you know, even when, you know, when you get, like we were talking about earlier, when you're sort of getting sick of hip hop, you know, you can always look at a picture of Biz Markie making a face and it's great. And it brings totally. You back to that second. And he will always sort of embody that, man. You know, Biz Markie with his face open, or with his mouth open, making a face is just, I don't know. It really, like you said, is like the embodiment of all that's good with hip hop. I mean, his presence alone. I mean, no one's saying he's the best singer. No one's saying he's the best rapper or has the best beats or blah, blah, blah. But he is the best. You know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah, totally, totally. I'm sitting here. I kind of grabbed my little stack of records just to riff on while we were doing this, and like I think everyone can agree that they need a haircut right now.
Right.
we're in an area where they opened up haircutting places for 2 days and then they shut them down again, and now I believe they're letting people do it outside. I saw my first outside. They had like a pop-up Jesus. Tent like the farmer's market, and they were cutting someone's hair. It's gonna take me a while to get used to that idea. Like the kind of germaphobe in me is totally. Like, huh,
Is that a good idea? Like having like all this hair blowing around?
Totally, totally. And just any service where you're that close to another person, it's more like, it's more like I don't want to get them sick, you know?
Totally. I guess the science of it is if you're both masked up, and I think in a lot of cases the haircut provider has the face shield and you're facing away from them, there's really no way for the droplets to come back. But
jeez,
dude, did you follow what's happening in baseball? A team, the Miami Marlins, I believe, I think eight or 14, I've seen different estimates. It's hard when the timeline is out of order, have COVID. So like
their
status is kind of unclear for the resumption of the baseball season.
Which, Gavin Newsom stepping in to stop it.
it's funny, the NBA's relaunch in the bubble, as they call it, in Orlando has had its issues, but they at least solved for the metric of travel.
Mm-hmm.
Baseball's plan was to have the team still go to the different stadiums. I think the Blue Jays, because they're based in Canada and because there's so much weirdness with borders and visas and passports and crossing right now, are playing in upstate New York or something.
Uh-huh.
But other than that, the plan was for these 32 teams or whatever to still travel the country, including like dipping into Florida and California where the disease is rampant, and then dip back out to like Michigan or St. Louis. You know, it's just like, what?
Yeah, that's terrible.
I just can't see that going on. Like, I can't see that actually working in a way that like we have a season.
Totally, totally. Yeah, it's weird, man.
And were you ever into baseball?
I was never really into it. I kind of got swept up in it as a kid. You know, I collected baseball cards and stuff. You know, I watched Jose Canseco and Mark McGwire kill it in the 80s, and they were the Bash Brothers and things like that. But I was never a super baseball guy. I was more of a basketball head.
Yeah, for sure. I had my times. Yeah, I definitely have had my times. Like there's been a couple really good Giants teams where I kind of got swept up in it. And when I got out of college, like when I was in college, I like focused on art and music and culture and like reading and like social histories and stuff like that so hard that when I got out, I was like, oh, sports are fun and sports have like this social element, right? So I read Bill James' book, A Baseball Abstract, and it's kind of the launching point for like the statistical revolution. Like his views on taking different statistics and like what they actually meant in terms of the opening market forms the basis of the Moneyball philosophy and all that stuff. So I read the Bill James book and the Mike Lewis, I believe is his name, book Moneyball that summer when I got out of college. And at that time, you could go to A's games and get front row tickets for like $15. So for one specific day, I was like out of college. It was the summer after college. I hadn't decided what I was going to do with my life yet. And I just drove up to Oakland, walked up to the box office, and I didn't even really watch the game. I just kind of listened to the game while I read my baseball books and sat in like the third row.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was a super fun day. And like, I'll never be able to do anything like that again, not only because of COVID, but like, I'm glad I did stuff like that, like when it mattered. And I was just trying to take like a kind of a different view of the game. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah,
kid, you just root for like, I always rooted for the local teams. I don't like.
Same.
I never liked the Pittsburgh Pirates or whatever. You know, it's just like, it's like I'm going to read about the team my dad likes. And like,
totally. You're going to read
go
about
the game. And
right, right.
So it was just like, once I kind of learned about this different take on things, and now it's actually funny just to drag it screaming back to hip hop. You see that Twitter account, Hip Hop by the Numbers. Like, literally none of that would have happened without Bill James and like kind of like the Nate Silverization of like taking statistical models and like representing things in like a kind of well-designed numerical format as a way into a different kind of analysis. You know how he weighs like this many punchlines, this many similes,
of course,
super nerdy. Obviously I know he has his detractors, but I always think it's interesting that he takes the time to like count the punchlines, you know what I mean? Like,
totally
I can't imagine doing that with my life, but I do find the data to be interesting.
100%. I mean, but that's once we get the data and you kind of look at it as a from a glance, you know. After a while, I mean, statistics, there's a tipping point where it's like, all right, enough.
Yeah.
You know, just play the game.
Yes.
But, or just.
Like, is the song good? I don't
know. Right. Care. Totally.
28 similes if the song sucks.
Exactly.
Anything else you've been listening to, or anything else like from the last couple of weeks you think is noteworthy rap music?
Rap wise, I mean, I'm still on the Blue in Exile. I think this is week two of that. We spoke about this one a little bit earlier in the year, but the Stove God Cooks, I've been really into, but so much so that I've just been checking out the instrumentals. The dude's voice can kind of grind, even though I like his personality and the persona that he brings.
Yeah, man,
some of those beats are so good. So I've just been checking for the instrumentals a lot, and it makes for really good sort of working music, you know. So I'm on my laptop and I got some kind of slow beats in the background that can be lush or kind of minimalistic too at certain points. So yeah, they're both it works for me. That's what I've been listening to. Sort of to your point earlier, I've been listening to a lot of non-hip-hop stuff the last couple of weeks, so, and that's always really refreshing to dive back into, you know.
Totally. Yeah.
What about yourself, Nate?
I really like the production, but not the full musical experience of the new Haim album. Like, they have this interesting drum sound. They had this song called Summer Girl that actually came out quite a bit before the summer, I think around the holidays, that kind of set the tone for this project. And there's, like, weird, like, kind of like AM Gold, like, saxophone and these really slappy drums.
Okay.
And I don't like every track, but I liked enough of it to, like, listen to it as an album. And I'm like, oh, man, like, quarantine is, like, pushing me in these weird directions. And then,
I'm sorry.
You would think I would like The National and Bon Iver, and I actually do like a little bit of the early Bon Iver, but like I tried the Taylor Swift album.
Oof,
couldn't do it, dude. That, first of all, it's not an indie album, no matter who co-writes the songs with her, because it's so cleanly recorded,
right?
So
right.
Glimmering. It's like you don't go into the woods and make some kind of like shimmering
totally
pop thing, you know what I mean? Like, it's you got to bring a four track or something if you really want that grit that kind of defines like indie music. Not that people don't have access to computers or laptops, it's a bit of an oversimplification, but I've never really understood her music. I think she's both overly praised and overly reviled. Like, she's just so big that people imprint their like emotions onto her. But when I heard she had made like kind of like a foresty indie folk album, I'm like, oh, I have to listen to that.
Okay.
Made it through 1.5 songs.
Swiftly turned it off.
Exactly.
I've been listening to this Charlie Magura record, that Numero Group re-released.
Oh, nice.
It is fucking fascinating. Firstly, I never knew about the dude. So, I mean, he's like this Israeli-born bedroom musician who did sort of slow surf music instrumentals and dark sort of Joy Division sounding stuff.
Whoa, you just sent me that link, dude.
Yeah, totally. It's really good. It's another Numero sure shot. It's great. And it comes with a fantastic booklet. And Charlie actually committed suicide in like 2016 or something.
Oh, wow.
So this is, it's not posthumous work, but it's a collection of his best stuff. And it's so, so striking, dude. It's like my favorite shit of like the last few months.
Oh, that's amazing. I definitely need to check that out. And I will say I have been listening to the new project of our guest today, Odyssey.
Yes, sir.
He made a quarantine baby. like Nappy Nina said on the show, his new album, The Odd Cure, is it's kind of a snapshot of this moment in his life, and I've definitely found it to be compelling.
Yeah, I mean, once again, he's proving how solid and even-handed he is over and over. You know, the rapping parts are great, the production is great. I didn't get a chance to look at the credits to see exactly who did what on what, but the overall vibe of it, I like. And, you know, we've been checking for Odyssey, you know, for quite a while. So it's good to get him on the program.
Yeah. So that interview is coming up now with rapper, producer, artist, and just like very interesting person, Odyssey, Dad Bod Rap Pod.
Dad Bod Rap Pod. Every week we have dope interviews, and this week is not any different. We have Odyssey, producer, rapper extraordinaire out of Brooklyn by way of DC, and whose new album, Odd Cure, we've been really big fans of, been checking this guy out for years. Welcome to the show, man.
Thank you. Thank y'all for having me, man.
Isn't it PG County, not DC? Should we get into it?
Oh, is that?
There's a moment on the new record where he talks about making the documentary, and that's where Kevin Durant is from. So
we're
Warriors fans, and we heard a lot about PG County for a couple of years, but you tell us, man.
That's a good springboard.
Is that where you're from?
You know what? That's absolutely correct. I'm from Prince George's County, Maryland. For those outside of the area, the minute you say you're from Maryland, people think that you're from Baltimore. Mm. And I'm from a suburb of Washington, D.C. So oftentimes we'll say D.C. for people outside from the mid-Atlantic area who have no idea what Prince George's County is. But thanks to Kevin Durant, I think more and more people know about PG now, the real Wakanda, you know.
Nice. So let's get into the new record. It is called Odd Cure. And it sounds and it is presented like it was kind of made with these times in mind, or perhaps under the conditions of these times. And certainly there's a lot of moments, interstitial stuff of you calling and checking in on your family and friends and how they're handling the current moment. Can you just kind of give us clarification? Like, were the songs crafted during this time as well, or did you kind of wrap the quarantine era stuff around it? And then I guess just kind of like, had you planned to put it out, or did you do it because this moment presented itself?
Sure. I scrapped what I was working on when I came home from Thailand on March 9th, and I was quarantined to my studio for 14 days as instructed by my wife. She said, you know, I understand that you're going to go abroad at this time and, you know, make a living, but we want to live when you come back. So she said I had to quarantine myself in my studio. So I did for 14 days. And that is when this record was conceived, produced, written, recorded, and mixed.
Wow. And just a straight one-man show?
No. I was lucky. I was unfortunately lucky to be quarantined with my engineer.
Gotcha.
Oh, wow. Okay.
My engineer, his name is Elphick Woe. He goes by the artist name Delph. He is originally from Hong Kong and had decided to move to New York just before the pandemic, towards the winter of 2019. And I met him in that summer of 2019. I met him earlier than in Hong Kong at a festival. We had a mutual acquaintance. I was looking for an engineer. One of my favorite engineers is his mentor, and Delph was his apprentice. So I lucked up with this guy, decided that he wanted to live in New York. We were already working out me sponsoring him and bringing him to America to be my engineer full time. Paperwork had already been done, et cetera. COVID hits. He comes back from Hong Kong. He quarantined at my studio for 2 weeks before I ever got back. Mm. And when I said, hey man, last minute show in Thailand, I'm going out to go get a bag. He's like, what? You're going to Thailand now? I was like, yeah, a bunch of people have dropped out of festivals because they're scared. And I get to make headline money for nothing. Like, I just get to go out and do like 40 minute sets. It's five cities.
Wow.
Mind you, I had five cities, but by the end of it, all but one city canceled. Every city, Jakarta canceled, Kuala Lumpur canceled, Manila canceled, Singapore canceled. The only one that didn't cancel was Bangkok. And I went around the world to do one show. I trust you, it was worth it. And when I came back, I said, listen, man, I got a quarantine. It's up to you. You want to go stay at your girlfriend's house or not? He's like, listen, it's all good. I'll stay here. And I was like, you sure? He's like, yeah. I think we'll be fine. It's like, all right. So we quarantined in the studio and I'd make a beat and write to that beat. And while I was writing to that beat, I would export it to him and he would start mixing the beat. Then when I finished writing, he would record me and he'd continue mixing the song as I was working on the next track.
Wow. And
Yeah. That was that. Yeah.
That is mad efficient, man. let's just dive into your working process just a little bit more. Obviously you can produce and write and rap. Which gets you more excited? Lacing a rapper with a beat, or you getting to attack a beat?
Honestly, I haven't had a chance to lace many rappers with beats, but I will say that I love equally producing and writing. They're two sides of the same coin for me. Like, they really give me the same feeling. I'll be walking down the street and I'll have a melody come to my head and I'll hum it in my phone and then I'll go into the studio and compose it.
Oh, wow.
I could be walking down the street and I have a bar come in my head and I pull over and I open up my notes and I write it down. And it's the same feeling. Same explosions go off in the brain, the same feeling of reward happens. And it really comes together when the songs are complete. I do say that I really love songs. I'm not a very big beats and rhymes type of hip hop artist. It does really nothing for me when I hear amazing lyricism over lackluster production or amazing production with lackluster lyricism. I'm really more so impressed by overall the end product.
Right.
So I really love just songs more than anything.
Okay. Well, sort of on that tangent, Nate and I were talking about just, the recent influx of quality music, quality rap and stuff. What artists are you checking for these days?
Oh, man. I like Bad, Bad, Not Good, 1500 and Nothing. I like Butcher Brown. What else am I listening to these days? I like Saba, Smino. Those to name a few. I really like those guys a lot.
Dope. Nice. So, right on, man.
Let's talk about a song from the new record. I would love to hear the kind of story behind the creation tale of Go to Mars. We've been talking about wanting to escape. We just did a whole segment on needing a kind of digital detox and needing to get out into the woods and get away from just the monotony of our current lives. That feeling and the kind of that joy of that escape, I feel like was evident in a song like that. Can you talk us through a little bit about what went into the making of that one?
Yeah. I really love hearing other people's perspectives of my music. It's the best. So let's get into it. Go to Mars is about, it's a metaphor for the 1% and their ability to escape the woes and tribulations of the average person. And how they metaphorically live on Mars now while the rest of us have no way to get on board, let alone sustain ourselves in the new world that they inhabit.
A whitey's on the moon. Scenario. Right.
It's a true metaphor for the world that the 1% lives in. The subject matter came about when I think I was watching either The Daily Show or A Closer Look, and it was talking about the growing economic gaps that COVID-19 had kind of ripped the Band-Aid off of to see this actually is not a great equalizer. That people who are wealthy are actually getting wealthier in a time where there's 40 million plus people unemployed, And it made me reflect on that, where it's like, well, they really live within a world of their own, within this world. And here we are trying to go to Mars, where there are people who essentially live in their own, fortresses of worlds right here on Earth. And I really wondered about minorities, in particular the Black community, who do all that they can to be accepted by that 1% and pray that they can get on board that ticket that allows them to escape the squalor and the trials and tribulations of the average person. So the song is actually written from the perspective of a Black man who feels as though he played by the rules and life still cheated him, and then decides to try to join the 1% and become a bigot and do anything that he can to escape the life that he grew up in.
Wow. That's so interesting. That was a totally different. I was nowhere near that. That's fascinating.
Well, I write in layers. I'm a big fan of The Simpsons, and I write in layers so that you get different levels of it, where definitely it's an escapism song in a time where everyone wants to escape. That's the first layer. And then the second layer is it's a metaphor for the 1%. And then the third layer is the deepest, where it's a self-hatred in minority communities who do manage to make it into the upper class or into the 1%, and how they turn their backs on the people who share their same shared history. For sure. It's like a three-level meaning to it. Yeah, so you're not wrong. You're definitely not wrong.
have you ever seen that movie Elysium? It's a Matt Damon movie. It's the guy who did District 9, Neil Blomkamp's like sophomore movie.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. No.
It's not a good movie, but it illustrates similar points to what you're talking about. And Elysium is their 1% off planet world. It, worth a watch if you're on that wavelength already. But don't expect a good movie. But it has some interesting.
I think I saw that, and I also watched that Brazilian series 3% that was on Netflix that was also similar to that subject matter.
Gotcha.
And there are people who are willing to sell themselves and a lot of other people with them to metaphorically go to Mars.
Right. You know? Yeah. That, wow. I'm glad I asked. That is fascinating.
Super fascinating.
Dave?
Yeah. Odyssey, since we got you on the program, I just want to let people I want to let you have a chance to let people know about your music. Can you let the folks know what Diamond District is about and maybe what they should check for?
It sounds like you want them to know about that.
I'm turning this camera.
I would have just talked about my album. No, it's fine by me. Do you want me to talk about some of like my press projects and stuff?
Yeah, totally. I just want usually when we have guests on, I view it as an educational thing, you know, and I just want people to learn about your history. So
yeah,
that's it.
Sure. Yeah, man. I'll try to sum it up. So from Prince George's County, Maryland, grew up next door neighbors with Gary Scheider and his two sons, Marshall and Garrett. I know him as Mr. Scheider, but he was a musician in Parliament and Funkadelic. Mm-hmm. He's a guy who wore the diaper on stage. So my first exposure to music was in his studio. He had a full analog studio in the basement. We'd come home from school, and me and his sons would just jam. Mm. Drum machines, ADAT tapes, you know, full-on mixer boards, no loops in sight, just tapping stuff out by hand. From there, got into a high school hip-hop crew. And I started rapping with local guys in my neighborhood and in my county. And once we kind of got our stuff together, and I was in a crew called Low Budget Crew in the beginning of my career with my man Kevin Brown, if you ever heard of Kev Brown. Kev Brown got it started in A Touch of Jazz with DJ Jazzy Jeff, producing for the likes of De La Soul, Bumpy Knuckles, Jazzy Jeff himself, et cetera. And it was Kev Brown who extended a handout to me. I played my first music for Jeff. I had my first paid song when Jazzy Jeff's The Magnificent album. From there, I got picked up by an indie label in New York called Half Tooth Records. Mm-hmm. And I put out several releases with them. I went independent for a while, bounced around doing releases with different labels on the West Coast, Japan, Europe, New York. From there, we start to get the direct fan marketing start to emerge with the likes of MySpace, things like that. I gravitated towards it very early on and used it to self-promote directly to fans and book my own shows. I started doing my own tours in Europe through MySpace in 2006. Mm. I was booking about 20-odd city tours through MySpace and sleeping on promoters' couches. 700 euros a show. One-way train tickets, that's all they had to pay for. I had a nice little hustle. I had a Euro pass, which was unlimited travel for a month, covered. Mm-hmm. I pay for it up front, and then I tell the promoters, all you have to do is give me 700 euro and pay for a one-way ticket. So I made the Euro money back super fast, like 2-3 trips.
Nice.
And then they thought they were getting a deal, but the exchange rate was crazy high back then. So 700 was over a grand in the States. You know, I could go over there make just as much money on a show, just getting reimbursed with the one-way tickets. And then I come back with the money, and then I sell merch. And it was at that point I started observing kind of a resurgence in, I guess what you could just call boom bap hip hop. And the reason why I was attracted to it, because I always like to go the opposite direction of what everybody else is doing. And I felt it was at that time, mind you, I'm a fan of like all forms and music and subgenres of hip hop as well. And that particular time, it was like the mid 2000s going into 2010, rap had become pretty ambient with the likes of Hudson Mohawk, Flying Lotus, et cetera. We had a little bit of a moment where rap was very electronic. So in that moment where those artists were receiving the most attention, I wanted to do a throwback record to something that sounded completely analog as a way to be a juxtapose to that. I went back home to DC. I hooked up with my longtime friends, XO and YU. And I said, though, let's form a group called Diamond District, because DC is shaped like a diamond. It's the District of Columbia. And I said, let's do a boom bap hip hop record, because DC's never had one. You know, if we go back into the 90s, I know where Queens Bridge is, or Marcy Projects, and right. Linden Boulevard, and Watts, and Crenshaw, and Fifth Ward, and Magnolia. And we don't have that record in DC where we shout out neighborhoods, blocks, cities, people. We rap in our accent, you know? And I said, let's do this record. And we did it. We liked it. Q-Tip liked it. Primo liked it. And we found ourselves touring that around the world. And it became a very much a cult classic amongst people who were into that sound of music. And a lot more records since then.
Yeah. Dope, man. Dope.
That is an exceptional answer. We asked a lot of people a lot of questions, and you had that ready to go, and I appreciate it.
Thank you for that.
No worries. No worries. I think I stopped at like 2010.
Yeah.
Okay. So,
all right. So we need to be on your podcast, because that's a good segue into my next question, which is my favorite record of yours is Rock Creek Park, and I think
that's there you go.
Where I picked up the thread of what was going on. I was a record store buyer, and in that world, you get a lot of promos and you get access to a lot of music, but I was also incredibly jaded. So it was kind of like a breath of fresh air to get this kind of self-produced analog feeling musical hip hop project. And I guess what I wanted to ask you is, it seems like live textural elements of actual musical instruments is a really big part of your process. Do you play them, or do you hire that out? Do you sample yourself? Like, I guess I'm, if you don't mind giving us a peek behind the curtain, how do you get that great texture?
Sure. I do everything in Pro Tools. I work with MIDI instruments first and electronic instruments, and I do root notes and pretty basic chord progressions. Sometimes I'll start with samples and I'll build around the samples, sometimes not. In the end, it's a skeleton track. And my band that I tour with, Good Company Band, they play on every record. It's Dennis Turner on bass, John Lane on drums, Ralph Real on keys, DJ Unknown on electronic triggers and samples, and Olivier Saint-Louis on guitar and vocals. So my normal process is, I'm in New York, I chop up samples, I compose them, I play MIDI instruments over top of them, stop. Call Ralph, he either comes up or we do remote access where I control his desktop from Brooklyn, and he's in York, Pennsylvania, and he hears the chords I play, and he's like, all right, I know those chords, and then he plays them, he has the finger work in between, and we work on harmonies, and once he's done, he sends me back the MIDI, and then I'm the one who ends up picking the final sounds and how it's EQ'd. Once that's done, same thing with Dennis Turner, my bassist. I'm actually in his basement right now. We just had rehearsal.
Nice.
And Dennis will play bass on tracks, and same situation. I'm just playing root notes with a sub, some type of sine bass. And I call him up and say, that's the idea. I'd like to hum it to you, because I can't read music. He hears it. He's like, oh, yo, he flat D minor, just haven't got it. And he sends it back to me, and then that's done. And then I send it to Olivier, he's in Berlin. And I said, I'm looking for a rhythm section that has this syncopation and in these chords. And then I sing it. He says, okay, I know those chords. He plays it and he's like this? I'm like, yeah, like that. Like this? Right. I'm like, no. And then he finishes it and then he sends it. And he always, everyone does everything dry. Everybody's EQs have to be dry, no delays, no effects. I like to do all of that myself. So it's very much samples, MIDI tracks, one by one with my band. Then I remove the MIDI and the samples. And then I commit to the wave audio. And then now I no longer mix. I have someone else. Delph started mixing. I needed to decrease my workload. I'm wearing too many hats these days.
Right. So it sounds musical because it is. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, there you go.
Excellent explanation. I think the people who listen to this who are producers or aspiring producers are going to get a lot out of that because you have a distinctive sound, and it sounds like it was hard won through trial and error, and like you've got a process that works for you.
It's a sound that's it's based off compounded experience. I can't stress that enough. Where sure you can understand like the basis on how it's conceived, but the compound experience of listening to music growing up, listening to what my parents were listening to and absorbing 70s and 80s music and it being imprinted in my brain, being next door neighbors with Mr. Scheider and making analog music and mixing on analog boards, having beat machines at a time where beat machines were king, from, you know, Pete Rock to DJ Premier and Jay Dilla, then transitioning into like a neo-soul era and getting my start in Philly with a touch of jazz with Jazzy Jeff, and humanizing MIDI bass and triggered production, transitioning into DAW and realizing that you can achieve swing and a higher, like a warmer quality sound, even though it's all electronic, based on just understanding those records. Mm-hmm. And being from DC and growing up in an environment of live music, with go-go music being our local music, over electronic music, and now working with a band. So it's that those things together that help it sound the way it does as well, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. Just to bring it back to the new record, how do your family and friends feel about being featured on vocally on one of your projects? Did you play it back for them? Did you tell your grandma you're going to use it? Like,
I didn't. She's actually the only one I didn't tell. So everyone else, when the conversations were done and I hung the phone up, I called them back and said, "Hey, I just recorded our conversation. Is that okay?" And everyone was like, "I didn't say anything crazy, did I?" I was like, No, you're good. You're good. It's like, can I use it? They were like, yeah, of course. But I didn't tell grandma. Grandma was surprised. Yeah, she loved it. She played it back over and over because she's never really heard her voice played back to her like that.
Yeah, I will say, I listened to your record. I was on a long walk, and when the record was done, I immediately switched apps and called my grandma. I had done that kind of at the beginning of the quarantine, but I hadn't done it in a while, and I was like, dude, I'm overdue. I gotta call my grandma and tell her, just check in. Man. And it was about the same length of phone call. It's just like, you good? I'm good. You good? All right.
My grandmother's not a phone person. She's really quick on the phone. She's one of the most busiest 89-year-olds I know. Like, she doesn't, like, she's got some story she's watching, some game show, rehearsal for church. She still plays organs in her church and keys.
Wow.
You know, like, she's a very busy woman. She still drives and gets her own groceries.
Dope.
You know? Dope. Yeah.
Honestly, I mean, you mentioned that you were at rehearsal right now. Since Odd Cure just came out and people are still sort of absorbing that right now, what are you working on?
I have another EP coming out in probably a month or more, maybe 5 weeks max. And then after that, I have a full-length album coming out in late September, early October. So I'm finishing those things, and then I got a bunch of other releases. By the time 2020 is near done, I should have about 40 songs out.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Perfect.
I guess it won't matter because people didn't hear it, but I'm just curious, and I feel like this is a good way to wrap the conversation up. Are you returning to what you were working on pre-pandemic, or are you scrapping those forever?
Okay. No. I'm returning to those things. That's why I've got so much music now. Yeah.
Right on. Sure. Yeah. Well, we are excited to listen to it. You were an excellent interview, and I think it's rare to find someone who can
explain what they do so succinctly, and so I just appreciate the like peek into
thanks, man.
Mind. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. I appreciate yeah. you.
We,
guys.
We get a lot thanks of like, oh, asking. You know, all right, you know what I'm saying? It's like, no, no, listen, at all.
I just my band just did an interview, and I told them I really want you guys to do this interview because, and I want you to do it without me. Because you need to get better at interviews.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, this is just compounding experience and media training. Like,
right.
You got to be concise. You know, you got a product to sell, sell it, give it backstory so people are interested. You know the deal. You know, I don't want to show too much on how the magic trick is done. So,
yeah, no. Like, interview. Really nice to talk to you. Really into the new project. Can't wait to hear the rest of what you've got to come out soon. So, appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you guys very peace, much. Odyssey. I appreciate y'all time, man. Y'all all be right. safe.
Okay. Thank you so much, man. Peace.
Peace.
Take
later.
Care.
Peace.
Dad Bod Rap Pod, that was our interview with Odyssey, the precise, technical, but soulful producer rapper who I feel like we learned a lot about.
Totally. I loved his I loved like the thoughtfulness of his answers and the sort of pacing of his sentences. You know what I mean? Like
yeah.
And he even revealed that he was talking to his band a little bit about how to approach interviews and stuff. And you can see by his, you know, thoughtfulness and his approach of just, it's something he's practiced before. You know what I mean?
And like being a good interview is a good way to get people to write about you.
100%. 100%.
So it's worth investing in, I guess I would say, for other artists who might be listening, like, for us, from our point of view, that was an excellent interview because he considered the question.
Right.
He had something to say, and he said it in a way that was usable for us. Like, whether exactly. we were writing a print article, it would be even more helpful for that. With a podcast, you can just kind of riff and talk. But, man, I was really, really impressed with some of his answers. And, like, he is, like, a business.
Right, right. I mean, he was talking about going to Thailand to get a bag, you know what I mean? And
totally.
and how the effects of COVID sort of encroached on everything. Fascinating. And, you know, he was actually at rehearsal when we talked to him. So people who are really into the new record, there's more stuff on the way.
Yeah, apparently. It seems like there's a lot of new Odyssey tracks coming our way, which is just good for everybody. Gonna switch gears a little bit. We've got a guest who is from the podcast universe. Dave, this is someone you know a little bit better than I do. Why don't you tell the people who's up next?
We got the one and only Morgan Rhodes. And even if her name doesn't ring a bell immediately, her voice I'm sure does. If you've heard Heat Rocks, her wonderful podcast with Oliver Wong. They have ridiculous guests all the time and they just nerd out. It's in many ways a high-level podcast. I mean, it's a pleasurable listen every time. She is also a music supervisor. She's involved in a lot of Netflix stuff. Dear White People, she's involved in this upcoming project called Vinyl Nation that she talks about. And yeah, man, just really looking forward to hearing more.
Yeah,
from what she does.
We love Heat Rocks. Dave was invited to be a guest, and that was a big moment for all of us as like kind of a show. Hearing Morgan say Dad Bod Rap Pod on
yes.
Heat Rocks, I like immediately went in and tipped the audio. I'll just listen to it sometimes. I love her voice. We used it as a drop on a mix we did. She's just like such a cool person. I had never met her before today.
It's so weird. Lovely.
I still don't know if it counts that we've met or not now that we've Zoomed.
Right.
I don't
right.
know where the semantic line on that is, but it's we just kind of got off the call with her, and so we're doing this a little bit backwards, but it's the next interview. So why don't you guys check this out, and we'll come back for a little wrap-up segment afterwards. This is our interview with music supervisor and podcast host Morgan Rhodes, Dad Bod Rap Pod.
Dad Bod Rap Pod. We're here this week again with an amazing guest. Every week we bring you either writers, journalists, producers, rappers, but we ultimately give you the good, the best musical minds. This week we have Morgan Rhodes, music supervisor, host of Heat Rocks with Oliver Wong, and just an incredible person. Good to have you here. How are you doing?
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here. I'm doing well considering all. Just happy to be here.
Right on. Nate, you want to just lead off with a couple questions? Sure.
So, Morgan, if you would, just give it to our, hopefully our listeners are familiar with Heat Rocks, but if they are not, can you give them the kind of, what's the show about? How did you and Oliver connect? And like, what's the kind of the hook of Heat Rocks that makes it the special music podcast that it is?
Sure. Oliver and I met while we were doing a segment called Tuesday Reviews Day on radio station KPCC. And I had never met him before. And we got paired together. I don't know if it's because we were both talking about black music. He was talking about hip hop. And I was sort of talking about what we call left field soul or avant-garde R&B. And it was cool. We did that show together for 4 years. And before we knew that the segment was going to come to an end, he was like, you know, do you want to do a podcast? Mm. And I was like, man, that's not me. I'm not into podcasts. I don't listen to podcasts or whatever. But I like talking to him about music. So we did a pilot episode about The Chronic because at that time it was the 25th anniversary. And we did it with one of his friends, Lauren. And it was a fun experience talking about it. And I'm from LA, so I had a lot of fun revisiting the album. Mm. And then Heat Rocks has been going on for 3 years. We originally thought, well, we'll just talk about it. You know, we'll just talk about music, me and you. And then I thought, well, let's have the opportunity to give artists a chance to be generous to other artists, because so often artists get asked in interviews, like, who influenced you? And a lot of those people are no longer here. Mm. And so we wanted to give artists an opportunity to be generous and shout out people who are still alive to hear, because everybody needs to know at some point that people like what you do. Mm-hmm. And so that's how it was conceptualized. And our first episode was with Joy, who chose a Bette Davis album, and it just went from there. Then we had Dame Funk, and it's just turned into something. I mean, I love talking about music, and I'm just a music fan. Oliver's the scholar. I'm just a geek, but I just relentless factoids that have no place other than a discussion about music with somebody as smart as Oliver. So it's worked out. We've been doing it and so far so good.
Dope. Well, you know, I was lucky enough and honored enough to be on the program and talk about Liquid Swords with you guys. I had a blast. And you know, like you were saying, I mean, the concept is somebody goes on the program and picks an album to sort of nerd out over. What would your album be if you were on Heat Rocks?
Not fair, man. That's not fair.
Maybe even a couple.
You know, it's so I've been so blessed on the show because so many people have picked things that I would talk about. Mm-hmm. We did a show with Cy Smith. She picked Michelle and Daniel Cho's Plantation Lullabies. So that would have been on. Mm. One of my colleagues who's a music supervisor, Keir Lehman, he chose Steely Dan's Asia. That would have been a pick. We talked to Ali Shaheed Muhammad about All in All, Earth, Wind & Fire's All in All. That would have been a pick. You talked about Liquid Swords. I love GZA. He's my favorite. You know, that would have been a pick. I'm sort of waiting for someone to get deep into Mary J. Blige's catalog. We sort of touched on What's the 411, but I'd like to do Share My World, Mary, you know, That My Life. Mm-hmm. Any fusion, any of the Weather Report, I'd like to get into. No one's really picked a gospel album except Van Hunt. So no one's really touched any of the icons. And gosh, for hip hop, we're starting to get into Outkast now. So we just did Equemini, and we did Speaker Box Love Below. And either one of those would have been my pick. So I think we've covered. I think we're circling that wagon, mm-hmm. but It would be tough. It's hard to pick your favorites. I just love so much music. It'd be hard for me to pick.
Right, totally. And I wouldn't have expected a different answer. I mean, it's so hard. You know what I mean? You know, I just to give people a little bit of a background. So you started off in radio and then transitioned to music supervision?
I did, random. And I tell this story a lot because I get asked about it a lot. But I think the benefit of sharing my story is to know that there's no one avenue into this business, or for that matter, in these times, no other business. And mm-hmm. I started in radio and got into radio because I wanted to do voiceover. And I wasn't a huge fan of my voice, but I was a fan of what I heard the salary was. And I was like, that's, you know, this is it. This is it for me, right? So my friend, and I've said this often before, said, well, what you need to do is just go up to a radio station and just hang out and talk a lot, you know, whenever you have an opportunity. And I was like, is that it? She was like, that's all you got to do. And, I believed her. You know, I was like, you know what? You look legit. I believe that. It was possibly the worst career advice I could have gotten for voiceover. Mm-hmm. But it led me to music supervision. So I started at KCRW. Went to KPFK, and that's when it happened for me. Just a random audition for a show, and then sort of the rest was history.
Dope.
So everyone tells us that music supervision is more than being a music nerd and picking the right song for the right moment, that a ton of it is the logistics, getting clearance, working within the budget and the framework of the production. And we're huge music heads. I think we both think we would love to pick music for music or TV shows someday. We've never taken any steps to get into it at all. But can you kind of demystify the art of what you do on the various film and TV projects and just kind of tell people what really goes into being a music supervisor in 2020?
Sure. Well, a bit of a cliche that we say around the business, that music supervisors have the most responsibility and the least authority. So part of what you have to do is diplomacy has to be your strong suit in terms of dealing with all the people that you deal with. On a film, you'll deal with a studio and also the director and producers. Part of your responsibility is not just to find songs, right? If they're just needle drops, finding songs for places. Mm-hmm. But you have to clear the music, and that comes down to two sides, the master side, which is the recording, and the publishing, which are the writers. What you've chosen, there might be 10 writers on that song. And if 9 of them say yes and 1 says no, you still can't use it. It isn't a majority thing. And so you get into deadlines. So you have to clear it. You have to do cue sheets. You have to work with the composer to make sure that all the cues are accounted for, not just the needle drops, but the score cues. You have to go to what we call our spotting sessions, which is you, the director, sometimes the showrunner. You sit in a room, you go through a picture, and you sort of decide, do we like this here, or do we want something else? And a lot of those decisions are informed by your budget. So, for example, I walked into a session one time, and one of the editors had put like a Jimi Hendrix track in there. I'm not going to say which one because I want to use it again one day. But he had put it in there, and it just gave me a heart attack because I knew what the budget was. And I was just like, who put this in here, you know? And the editor was like, well, a lot of people, you know, like Jimi Hendrix. And I was like, yeah, but we don't have that sort of money. So unfortunately, everyone was in love with that song. And how can you compete? Like who's a close second to Jimi Hendrix? Really, no one. But I ended up going with a blues track in that cue, which really worked. Thank God. So one of the things that you have to do is also negotiate rates with publishers and with labels. And there's all this terminology, most favored nations, and blah blah blah. There's all these kind of rights. But music supervisors also work in different areas like ads, trailers, and games. And gaming is the hot new place where music supervisors do work. They have gigantic budgets. Gigantic budgets. And that's why with games you hear so much rock and hip hop, because they can afford it.
That's fascinating.
If you do indie stuff in a game, you're just being a show off because you don't need to. Everyone's like, you know, whatever. But they have giant budgets, so So that's I hope I answered the question.
Absolutely, you answered the question. I want to take it in another direction, and this is often my interview style. I'm learning as we're rounding our mid hundreds of episodes here. I'm just going to say a thing, and I want you to tell me if it's true or not.
Yes,
I think one of the reasons that Heat Rocks works so well is that you mentioned earlier you have an intense command of factoids, but what you really bring to the show is this deep appreciation and love of music, and what you end up talking about most times is how the music made you feel. And I feel like that's there's a place for both, but the show wouldn't work without that balance. So again, that's not a question, but like, do you agree with my assertion that like the emotionality and the kind of where it touches on for people is just as important as knowing who drummed on what and what label it came out on?
I think it is important. And what's happened to us in the box sometimes is people have gotten really emotional, and that's the requirement for being on the show, not just to be, I mean, we could always have the scholars and people that have written books, but our requirement is that think carefully about the album that you choose, because we want you to be in love with it in ways that you can, this is something that got bumped over and over again, or this is something that you can tie a specific memory to. This is why we ask, where'd you get the album and when? Because most of us, and I'm sure you guys are the same, that love music, you can't separate that memory from that record store or that moment or the car you were in. And when we start off like that, it opens up this portal for people to draw on. Everybody knows, if you've listened to Heat Rocks, my thing with Earth, Wind, and Fire and my relationship with my dad, it keeps coming up. Well, my parents were divorced and I didn't see my dad for a long time. So what I had of him was those records. And so that's my portal into talking about it. Earth, Wind, and Fire just happens to be a great band. It could have been a hack band that we had in common, right?
Right.
But it isn't. It's Earth, Wind, and Fire. And so when we get people to talk about that, I'm not as concerned with how smart they are. I'm concerned with how did that make you feel? Like, what do you remember? And when you lead with the heart and your feelings, ultimately those factoids come up. You'll be like, and I remember this guitar solo, I remember that, or this, that, and the other. So I think to your point, it has to be emotion first. It really has to be. Because there's smart books written all over the place, but it's how it's how you feel about it. Like, for example, when you talked about Liquid Swords, I'd sort of been in the closet about my Jizza love, right? Because I feel like he's the people's champ and sort of the sentimental favorite. Because a lot of people don't see him in the same way, as charismatic as Method Man. Or, you know, they assign all this stuff to the RZA, and, you know, and I'm just like, mm-mm-mm. Jizzes, they don't call him the genius for nothing.
Right.
Pay attention. And so when you pick Liquid Swords, I was like, thank God. So.
No, that was so fun. I still think about it all the time. It was a really great experience. So thank you for having me on again.
Sure.
But you know, since we're on that subject, what's the working process with you and Oliver like when you guys are preparing for shows and just getting ready for for guests and ready to dive into an album? That's the first part of the question. The second would be, which guest has really struck you through the episodes you've done?
The process is we do our research. Oliver's a sociology professor, and he prepares for our shows like a professor. We've got a script that he gets together, and then we don't just riff. We don't do like that. We have a script and we know what we're going to ask before we sit down in the booth. Some things are magical. Some things just come out organically, but we know the structure. There's the same framework, your fire track, what's slept on, this in three words, whatever. So there's a certain framework, but our questions are tailored by the album. If this is a reissue, if this is their sophomore album or their debut, if this was a posthumous release or their swan song. So, it's structured that way. And then there's the preparation. We provide a lot of the music in advance, because if we have to reference something else, we don't want our editor, our engineer to struggle to find those. So we give him everything right away, so we have to cut to it. Mm. And he's got it, right? Especially when you got the guest in a box, because you don't want to fumble around sort of with that stuff.
Right.
So that's that. I think the one of the guests that moved me the most was, I think, was Joy talking about Bette Davis and how Bette Davis, we've had a couple of, we sat down with an artist named Adeline, and both she and Joy talked about how the artist they were speaking about gave them permission to be. Mm. And we're talking about Black women who had to pave the way. Of course, Bette Davis, you know, in the 70s, late 60s, 70s, and Chaka Khan in the 80s. And they both got emotional. So those have been some of the things that have moved me. But also we had The Last Poets In, and talked about, Father MD talked about what's going on. Mm. And to hear him do like spoken word on the spot, I mean, no pressure, it's just The Last Poets, you know. you know, but it was just so beautiful. And I think, you know, guys, if I'm really honest, like, we never know what someone's gonna pick, and that's the fun. I always try and size someone up, and I'll tell Oliver, oh, I already know. Like, I already know, like, you ain't gotta, you know, I know what they're gonna choose, and I haven't been right one time. And that's the fun of the show. We think we know, and then when we get those emails back from the publicist or their agent or their rep, and we're like, what? A great example was, we had the composer Chris Bowers on, and I know him, I've worked with him before, and he's he won the Thelonious Monk jazz piano competition, right? Wow. So I told Oliver, let's brush up on Thelonious. Like, I'm not well versed, but get ready. And then his publicist said, Chris wants to talk about Section 80. And we and we were like, Kendrick Lamar's Section 80? And I'm sure she was like, well, what other Section 80? So we were really surprised, because I was sure that he was going to go in that jazz direction. But he brought a lot of jazz to the conversation, because what he was trying to tell us was that if you listen carefully, there's so much jazz in Kendrick Lamar, and he's such a composer. And I just never would have thought about it, not for that album, maybe for To Pimp a Butterfly.
Right.
But he pointed out some things that I had never considered for Section 80, and that's what made that episode really fun for us.
Oh, that's awesome. So dope.
I have a question, just to kind of bring it back to the music supervisory realm. Would you mind telling us a story of like one that was just a home run? Like, you just nailed it. Like, you just felt like you found the perfect cue. It fit the budget, and like it was the cut at the right time. Do you have something like that you could tell us about?
Yep. An end credit song that I found for the third season of Dear White People. And it's a scene where the main character, Lionel, has, over the course of these episodes, has really stepped into his sexuality. It was rough going at first, but he's finally embraced himself and embraced, you know, his sexuality, and he's on campus, he's living his best life. So there's a montage scene where he's walking through campus and he's just looking at all these guys, and you know, they're attractive, and you can just see the look on his face. And I don't know what we had there, but years ago, and this is some geek thing that I do, I'm super old school, you probably can see this, but I have a lot of these, and inside I'll have, right, super, it's about paper, right? So I walk around with these, and I write down songs that I'll use someday if I have the opportunity. I have like 10 of these, just random. I'll hear something or I'll find something on Discogs. And I had found this song called, by The Miracles, called Ain't Nobody Straight in L.A. And not that many people knew about it. When I heard it, I was like, I just had that feeling. I was like, I don't know when I'm going to use it. And it's older. I think it might be 1972, whatever. And it worked. And we used it for the montage, and we used it for the end credit. And the chorus is, homosexuality is a part of society. And just sitting in the spotting session and have everybody sing that, you know, was a really good feeling. It was good for me, because every music supervisor, once you get to know us, we all have our calling card of the things that we like to do. I come from indie radio, so my sensibilities are indie. And I'm only in it to break artists. That's the joy of this job. Mm. I'd rather have, and I've said this often, I'd rather have somebody say, who was that? Then that's my jam. Mm. Because I really want to, even somebody like the Miracles, who people know but don't know that song. So I want to pull the covers off of things. And that was just one that worked. And I get asked about that all the time. And that was the Miracles.
You know? Yeah, I got chills when you were describing the spotting session. So yeah, that sounds amazing. I need to go back and rewatch that with knowledge. It's a very good show, and I think your work is amazing on it. It has a very noticeable, I don't know what the word is, like a consistency, where the music is just excellent in it. And I'll often Shazam things as I watch a show I like, and you know, I'm sure that's kind of what people are reaching for, is like, who was that? How do I find out more about this artist? And it just adds to the repertoire. So it's impressive.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Morgan, can you talk a little bit about Vinyl Nation? Because, you know, Nay and I, we both collect records, and Oliver the Scholar also does. And, you know, we're just like little record nerds. But I couldn't find that much information about it. Can you break it down and just give people a peek of what that's about and everything that's coming up with it?
Sure. Vinyl Nation is about this second generation of vinyl collectors who got into vinyl when vinyl made its resurgence. So it starts off, it opens with record store days around the world, around the country. And it talks to this new generation of fans, including little kids, and talks to them about their, you know, what's drawn them to buy records. It's so beautiful. It's so sweet to see the kids that are buying their first. I mean, it's just such a sweet way to open the film. It is also about record pressing plants, who, before I worked on Vinyl Nation, I really was ignorant about the landscape of that industry. In my mind, I saw these big warehouses. I thought every record pressing plant looks like Costco, and there's a whole bunch of people inside, and it really isn't. This industry was carried by mom and pop plants in various places in the country who thought that their business was done because people weren't buying records, right? So they laid off tons of people and they closed shops. And then Urban Outfitters, places like Urban Outfitters, started selling turntables, pink and blue and green. And all these kids started getting interested in vinyl. There's three or four kids in here. There's one kid in the film that's like, you know, he's like, listen, sometimes I listen to classic rock, and he starts naming down. He's like, other times I'm into Bowie, I'm into, you know, I'm just like, you got an 8-year-old kid. But that's what, I mean, but his ear is like crazy. Right. And these are, you know, he started collecting records because it came back into vogue. Mm-hmm. So Vinyl Nation is about what happened to these plants. How did they meet the demand? Because when it opened up, the floodgates opened up. Mm-hmm. But also, too, about how people are starting to get into vinyl again. And what does that mean for those of us that love vinyl to have this next generation be as interested in it as they are? It was a wonderful thing to be a part of. And it was supposed to roll out at the festivals, but then COVID happened. So that's why we don't have a release date for it yet, because it hasn't been acquired yet.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. Yeah, I was grasping for any information I could find, but couldn't really get too much. So thanks for breaking that down.
Sure.
That sounds so beautiful. I mean, these kids have a head start. I wish I did.
I mean, I can't wait till you see it, because it's just so endearing to hear the kids. I mean, it's just, and they're standing in line waiting for the stores to open. You talk to the record store owners. Mm. You guys know what vinyl means. You know how it feels to get those records.
Yes.
And it's part of my life.
It's just, and to watch little kids be excited like that. It was a fun project to work on.
Now that sounds so moving. Well, is there anything else you could sort of let us know that you're working on? Anything you want to get out there in terms of projects you're excited about, or just, I don't know, or just the record of the week you want people to check out?
Oh man, I'm working on the fourth and final season of Dear White People. Fourth and final.
It's a big chapter coming to a close.
Yeah.
It is, but it's so on brand, because the kids will be in their senior year. So this is the four years that they've been in college.
Yeah.
So I'm excited about that. I'm working on a film for Netflix called Mixtape, which is about an orphaned 12-year-old girl. It's set in 1999. And she's being raised by her grandmother because her parents got killed when she was a baby. And she stumbles around in the basement of her grandmother's house and finds a cassette tape, a mixtape that her parents left her. And she tries to play it, but the tape pops. And so she spends the rest of the film, she has a track listing. So she spends the rest of the film trying to track those songs down and to hear them for the very first time. She's 11.
Wow. 12.
So it's set in 1999, mostly punk and punk adjacent. And so I'm having fun with that one, because punk is a lot of things, but kid friendly is not one of them. And so trying to strike a balance between being kid friendly, family friendly, but also, you know, not making the kids, you know, headbanging out too hard. So I'm really excited about that. But in other places, there's a lot of rock in there too. So we've been asked to be, you know, to be obscure in places. So I'm excited about that.
Dope. Well, there it is. Well, thank you, everybody. Go out and check Heat Rocks with Morgan Rhodes and Oliver Wong. And Morgan, we just want to say thank you for gracing us with your presence and voice and knowledge and stories. We're big fans and I appreciate the time.
Thank you so much. Thank you guys for asking me. I sure appreciate it. And thank you for always shouting out Heat Rocks. It's not lost on us. We really appreciate that too. Thank y'all.
Absolutely. All right. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
Have a good one. Thank you.
Peace. You too. Bye.
Right, man, that was great. Morgan is as fantastic as you would think. Some of her stories gave me goosebumps. I mean, about how things hit the heart, and she was talking about Earth, Wind, and Fire, and you know how music nerdom can both be about statistics and how it makes you feel and representation and all that. There was a lot going on, and she couldn't have been any more lovely.
I just think she's such a soulful person. Like, I think, and I still don't think I asked the question right, but I was just blathering at that point. So I wanted to wrap it up and give her something to react to. But I just like wanted to tell her that like one of the reasons I listen to Heat Rocks, which as we mentioned a little bit earlier, is just an excellently produced podcast. And if mm-hmm. you're looking for something to model off of, the way they write their scripts, the way that it's edited mm-hmm. and composed, it's just like, the way they cut to the music, it's so good,
right?
That it makes me, you know, aspire to have our podcast be that good. And I don't think we're anywhere close to that, but we've tried to get better over time. But anyway, all that aside, the technicalities aside, what makes Heat Rocks good to me is that it has that balance of Oliver's erudition and hers. Mm-hmm. And it's just such a beautiful combo, and it's such a good show.
Totally.
It's so cool to talk to her.
And, you know, she actually stated that, like, they don't really riff. And I guess that's true in the traditional sense. But just sort of when they're going back and forth in an informal manner about, like, an album they're really into, like, that sounds like they're riffing to me, kind of. You know what I mean? It's so passionate and off the cuff.
A structured conversation that leaves room for improv, right?
Right, right.
Like, within these notes, you can solo kind of vibe.
Totally. Exactly. So, I mean, it was great to hear her talk about some guests that really blew her mind. And, you know, we turned the tables on her a little bit, and she talked about some records that she would have liked to talk about if she was on Heat Rock. So that was a fantastic conversation, man.
Yeah. I'm wondering if we should have made it more hip hoppy because we're a hip hop podcast, but this is the freedom that Damone's sick day affords us. Damone, we hope you get better soon. We hope you're, by the time you've heard this, you're on the mend and it's nothing serious, and we miss you, buddy.
Miss you, bud. Literally the illest host.
do you have anything you want to plug or anything like you want to talk about?
Nothing too much at the moment. Let me see. I just wrapped up a couple of pieces for Passion of the Weiss that I just sent over. I guess I can talk about it now. One is on the making of Rock Cocaine Flow with Jake One.
So we had started working on that before we interviewed him for the pod, right?
Exactly.
Nice. Yeah. So we purposefully didn't talk about Rock Cocaine Flow that much because Dave was doing this and we didn't want to step on his work. But for savvy podcast listeners, you'll remember that I Rock Cocaine Show, which got a lot of love in the group chat and none in real life. Nobody knew what I was referencing or what I was talking about.
Yeah, so that was really fun. I have that on the way, and I also did a piece with Buck Wild on the making of I Got a Story to Tell.
Oh, how cool.
By Biggie. So
a good story to tell?
But just both of those. Nothing too serious or too big, just little fun side things that I'm more than happy to do.
Awesome.
What about yourself, Nate? Are you working on anything?
I am, but nothing I can talk about.
Okay.
Cycle of refusing to finish things goes on, and I don't want to bore the audience with my inner turmoil, but pecking away at a couple of writing things and a couple of podcast things that people will hear when the time is right. So
yes, we're very excited.
Thanks, bud. Yeah. So people can find us on Twitter at DadBodRapPod. People can find us on Instagram at DadBodRapPod. And we're doing a newish thing where Friday nights, 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern, I don't know what time in other places, we're doing a little Instagram live, basically like a record nerd comedy show about the week's podcast.
It's like a bit of a recap to a bit of looking forward. Yeah, you know, all of that.
Because of the limitations of the technology, the three of us cannot do it together. So we're picking two guys a week to basically go in and interact with the guests. If you guys have questions for us, that's a good time to get them answered. We're not recording them and posting them to our IGTV, so we get to be a little bit more free in our
answers.
And it's more like funny than it is serious. But
some
people have stopped by, some rappers, some writers,
some
of our kind of like online podcast community cohort. So I've actually been having a lot of fun with that. It's like a nice way to wrap up the week.
Well, remember when they used to sell DVDs? this is like the Friday IG Live thing is like a DVD extra.
Yes, good way of putting it. We promoted the Twitter, we promoted the podcast, we promoted the IG Live, we promoted your stories. I think that's a show.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, man. Morgan. Thank you.
Thank you, Morgan. And thank you, Odyssey. And thank you for our listeners.
Absolutely. All right, guys. Take care of yourselves. Wear a mask. Dad Bod, Rap Pod.
Hey guys, this is Kenan Thompson. I have a problem with you. Yes, you. None of y'all told me that Auto Trader has millions of new and used cars that I can shop from home. I thought we were friends. I put smiles on your face, but I'm not smiling.
No one told me that with Auto Trader, a dealer can deliver cars to my home or that I could shop by price on Auto Trader. No one. Consider this friendship that you just learned we had officially over. Finally, it's easy. Auto Trader.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.